Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
The Lutheran Reformation in Great Britain with Pastor Roy Long.
In this second talk, we continue our walk around the City of London, looking at sites connected with the history of Lutherans in Britain. From Smithfield, we shall visit St Paul's Cathedral, try to find the site of the first Lutheran congregation in London, and look at the area down by the river where the home of the Hanseatic merchants stood. Our first stop is St Paul's Cathedral. From the Martyrs' Memorial in Smithfield to St Paul's Cathedral, continue along St Bart's Hospital, turning left at the corner down West Smithfield, which turns into Giltspur Street with the hospital on your left. At the intersection, cross over Newgate Street and turn left, keeping on and turn into Paternoster Square. Walk straight through the square, exiting under the Temple Bar. Passing by the west front of St Paul's Cathedral and turn left along the south side of the cathedral. Pass through the old gates, and in front of you, you will see on the pavement next to the church an outline of old St Paul's. It was here on the 12th of May 1521 that many of Luther's books were burned on the order of Pope Leo X after a sermon delivered by John Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, against Martin Luther. The Cathedral Church of St Paul, which overshadows you as you stand and look up at its great dome, is not the cathedral that would have been known to men and women of Tudor England. When Robert Barnes and the merchants of the Steelyard were forced to do penance at St Paul's Cross in 1526, they would have been outside the old medieval cathedral, which itself stood on a site where there had been a cathedral since Anglo-Saxon times. That building was the largest cathedral in England, 585 feet long, with a tower that reached upwards to 489 feet in height, and it was more than just a place of worship, but also a centre for trade and for business. The old cathedral was destroyed in the Great Fire of London in 1666, and the present building is its replacement, designed by Sir Christopher Wren. Although it is now recognised as one of the greatest church buildings in the world, Wren's plans didn't meet with approval when they were first presented to the Dean and Chapter in 1672, and he had to modify them considerably. The present cathedral took nearly 50 years to complete, and its highest point is 360 feet high, making it the second highest dome in the world, surpassed only by St Peter's in Rome. St Paul's Cross used to stand on a spot to the northeast of the old cathedral. According to historians, Londoners had gathered around this cross since at least 1241, and it became the place to come and hear the popular preachers of the day. Not only did these men preach sermons, but their sermons also served as a mouthpiece to deliver royal policy to the people. By Henry VIII's time, a lot had been added to the original cross. There was a pulpit at ground level, surmounted by a cross, and surrounded by a low wall, within which the best favoured of the audience could sit and listen. It's reported that sometimes several thousand people gathered there, and we can easily imagine the heat and the smell. Although St Paul's has never had very obvious Lutheran connections, it stands rather symbolically between Smithfield, where early English Lutherans like Robert Barnes died in the flames, and the place where the Great Fire of London started. It was the flames of the Great Fire which led ultimately to the establishment of the first Lutheran church in Britain, which was in Trinity Lane nearby. There is, however, a modern Lutheran connection, because every two or three years St Paul's plays host to a celebration of the Swedish Lucia Fest, and the cathedral in December resounds to the sounds of well-known Lutheran Advent and Christmas hymns. Lutherans and Anglicans, and indeed all Christians in Great Britain, can give thanks that God's word has been proclaimed on this spot and the sacraments have been administered almost since the first missionaries from the continent of Europe came to southern Britain in the 7th century. We praise God for all those who have witnessed to Christ in this building. From St Paul's Cathedral, we move on to the site of the first Lutheran church in Trinity Lane. Leaving St Paul's, continue with the cathedral on your left and exit through the far gates. Cross at the lights at the south portico and turn left on the other side. Continue down Cannon Street and turn right into Friday Street. At the bottom of this street, cross both zebra crossings and turn left so that you are walking along the right-hand side of Queen Victoria Street. Continue straight ahead, turning right at a small garden on a traffic island. To your left, you'll see the Royal Bank of Canada Centre, which is built on the site of Trinity Lutheran Church. This was the first Lutheran church in Great Britain, built between 1672 and 1673. Samuel Pepys is one of the great literary figures of the late 17th century, best known for the diary that he kept for more than a decade after the restoration of King Charles II in 1660. Writing in his diary for Sunday the 2nd of September 1666, he says, "Some of our maids, sitting up late last night to get things ready against our feast today, Jane called us up about 3 in the morning to tell us of a great fire they saw in the city." So begins Pepys's eyewitness description of the fire which devastated London in the late summer of 1666. Medieval cities in Northern Europe were very prone to such fires. After all, the staple building material was wood, and because houses were so tightly packed together, it was easy for whole neighbourhoods to burn down. But there had never been anything like the fire of 1666. It was to become known as the Great Fire. Hundreds of dwelling houses and public buildings, including most of the historic churches of the city, were reduced to ashes. Thousands of people were homeless, and the capital faced economic disaster. The only immediate good thing to come out of it was that it finally got rid of the last traces of the Great Plague, which had devastated the city the year before. King Charles II and his council faced a major dilemma, because the capital city obviously had to be rebuilt. But where was the money to come from to finance such a major task? The king had only been back on the throne for 6 years, after spending 11 years in exile in the Netherlands. And after a decade of poverty, Charles had been making up for lost time with a very extravagant lifestyle. Part of the answer to the problem lay in getting help from abroad, and particularly from the Lutheran countries and cities of Germany and Scandinavia. Now, we must remember that at this time, the Swedish kingdom, which was the largest in Northern Europe, included a large part of Northern Germany, particularly what we now call Pomerania. It also included a large part of what today are Estonia and Northern Latvia, all of which were traditional Hanseatic areas of influence. It was at this point that the merchants of the Hansa, based in the steelyard, came into their own. They were able to act as intermediaries between the English court and these potential sources of help. As a result, money began to come into London, and with it, craftsmen and builders to supplement the efforts of local artisans. It was against the background of this turmoil that the first official Lutheran congregation in England was established. The religious background of contemporary England wasn't favourable to the establishment of such a congregation. England had been torn apart by religious conflict in the 140 years since Martin Luther's first protest in 1517. Although the vast majority of people probably wanted nothing more than to live a quiet and uneventful life, there were extremists at both ends of the Christian spectrum. There were high church bishops and theologians, such as Archbishop William Laud, who had been executed in 1645, and they wanted to restore, to some extent, what you might call Catholic liturgical practices, and they were opposed by a varied and kaleidoscopic array of extreme Protestants. This had eventually ended in the Civil War, the deposition and execution of King Charles I, and an 11-year experiment with republican government. There were many who hoped that the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 would bring an era of peace and toleration, but the forces of reaction were too strong. In 1664, Parliament passed what was called the Conventicle Act, which severely limited the rights of those who did not subscribe to the beliefs and practices of the Church of England. And this resulted in many Puritan ministers being removed from their parishes in what was called the Great Ejection. We can be fairly certain that Lutheran services had already been held in London from time to time during the 17th century, because there were domestic chaplains who were attached, for instance, to the embassy of the Electorate of Brandenburg. Many of the Lutherans living in London at the time would have attended their services in the embassy and later on in the Swedish embassy. And in 1668, these Lutherans, including Jakob Jakobsen, who was the master of the steelyard, asked the Swedish ambassador, John Barkman Lionberg, to appoint a pastor by the name of George Martens to be their chaplain. Martens began to conduct regular services in Lionberg's home in Covent Garden. But it was obvious that an embryonic congregation such as this required a church of its own. Granted the religious circumstances of the time, such a church could only be built with the permission of the king, and a delegation, including both Lionberg and Jakobsen, approached the king, and against all odds were granted permission to erect a place of worship under the same conditions as the Strangers' Church at Austin Friars. Charles II wrote to his attorney and solicitor general, instructing him to prepare the appropriate legal documents. The subsequent letter, dated the 17th of June 1669, confirmed that, after due consultation with both the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of London, it had been decided to grant, to quote, "as a fit place for a church in our city of London for a German congregation, the site of Holy Trinity, one of the medieval parish churches destroyed in the Great Fire." The king requested that a bill be drawn up to be signed and sealed by him, granting the site of the church to the said resident of Sweden and other followers of the Lutheran confession and their successors residing in our said city of London. This was quite specific in stating that the same immunities, privileges and freedoms for their encouragement and government were to be granted to this church as had been granted to the French and Dutch congregations in London by the king's predecessors. The subsequent letters patent, dated the 13th of September 1672, formalised and expanded the contents of the first letter of June 1669, and confirmed that the Swedish ambassador and the six named individuals, all of whom it appears were German merchants, they were granted the site of Trinity Church in Trinity Lane on which to build a Lutheran church. The main provisions of the letters patent were quite clear. First, the church was to be built within 4 years. Second, it was to be a place of worship for all Lutherans, irrespective of their national origin. Thirdly, Within the church, Lutherans could celebrate their rites and ecclesiastical matters of their religion without any impediment. And fourthly, the congregation was permitted to call a pastor, and also, when appropriate, to dispense with his services. On the 21st of November 1672, the foundation stone of the new church was laid. It took less than a year to build, and on the 21st of December 1673, Holy Trinity Lutheran Church was dedicated with a service at which George Martin's preached. Incidentally, a modern typed copy of the text of the sermon runs to 21 foolscap pages. So, Holy Trinity Lutheran Church was born, and for the next 22 years it was the only place of worship for the Companions of the Augustan Profession, living in the London area. During most of that time, George Martin's was the pastor. He died on the 21st of March, 1686, but under his leadership, the congregation grew and flourished. Today, the church is no longer in the same place. It was rebuilt in 1773, in the same location, in order to cater for the growing numbers of German-speaking Lutherans in the city. But in 1871, the site was purchased by the Metropolitan District Railway Company, and the congregation moved to a new church in Dalston, in East London. This was consecrated on the 13th of July 1876, and although this building still exists, it's no longer a Lutheran church, and German services are now held further out from London in Essex. There was one very important restriction placed on the congregation. The letters patent said this: "Yet so that in such meetings of foreigners, our subjects and liege people born within our kingdoms or dominions, and also initiated with us into the profession of the name of Christ, according to the rites of the said Church of England, be by no means accounted privileged or admitted." In other words, just like the original Strangers' Church, this Lutheran congregation was a church for foreigners. Lutherans of any nationality could worship there, but it was assumed that if your nationality was English, then you had to be a member of the Church of England. This reflected the very punitive laws which related to church membership from the time of the Restoration onwards, although these laws were gradually relaxed, starting with the Toleration Act of 1689. Writing in a brief essay on the history of the congregation that he prepared on the occasion of the celebration of its 300th anniversary, Walter Ramger, who was the pastor in 1969, said this: "This action, the letter patent of 1672, provided the legal basis for a Lutheran congregation, in which Lutherans from various nations and of various tongues could find a common meeting place. A model type of Lutheran church, which we, the children of our 17th century ancestors, find hard to achieve today." This united congregation, where Lutherans gathered for worship irrespective of their nationality, was not to last. On the 6th of March 1692, King William III and Queen Mary II issued another letter patent, this time granting the Danish community the right to build a church of its own. And they, together with some Swedish members, left Holy Trinity and founded their own congregation. Holy Trinity thus became a purely German-speaking congregation. But in 1694, there was a dispute among the remaining members about whether members living in Westminster should have the right to vote, and this led to the founding of the second German congregation in London, St. Mary le Savoy. We now move on to the Steelyard Passage and All Hallows Church. Walk down the right side of the Royal Bank of Canada Centre, down Little Trinity Lane, following the street to the left. Continue straight on, and take the alleyway called Skinner's Lane, going alongside the church of St. James Garlickhithe. At the next intersection, turn right and cross Upper Thames Street, using the set of lights on your left. Turn left on the other side, and just before the underpass, turn right into Cousin Lane. Walk down it, and turn left into Steelyard Passage, which is just before the river. This is the area which was settled by the Hanseatic merchants. At the other side of the passage, turn left up All Hallows, back towards Upper Thames Street. At the corner, you'll see the Dewgate Fire Station on your right. This is the site of All Hallows Church. This was the church which welcomed North European Lutherans to their services, even reserving pews for them. The London of the late 16th century has been described as a metropolis of the international Protestant world, a crossroads for Protestant refugees. It's been estimated that there may have been up to 4,000 such Protestant strangers in London in the first years of the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, of whom at least half belonged to the Dutch and French congregations at Austin Friars and Threadneedle Street. These strangers were not confined to London. There were similar congregations in Canterbury, Colchester, Norwich and Sandwich. One significant group of such foreigners in England were the Germans, but there are serious difficulties when we use modern adjectives to describe nations of previous centuries. Today, in the 21st century, we can use a word like German and be fairly certain that we know what it means. For us, it means those peoples who are citizens of Germany, a vast chunk of land surrounded by other nations such as, among other, the Netherlands, Switzerland, the Czech Republic and Poland. However, as a nation, Germany didn't really come into existence until the German Empire was proclaimed in 1870. Before then, the word German was used to describe people who came from the many different states and communities that occupied territories stretching from the North Sea to the eastern shores of the Baltic, and who sometimes formed communities, such as those in the Siebenbürgen of modern Romania, which were surrounded by other nationalities. The word German sometimes encompassed people whom we would not consider German, such as the people of the modern Netherlands, for whom our English word Dutch is a corruption of the German word for German, Deutsch, or people who spoke dialects of German, such as Plattdeutsch, Low German. We need to bear this in mind when we talk about Germans in Britain. Having said that, we know that there have been communities of Germans in Britain since the earliest times, merchants and traders. Perhaps the most important group were the members of the Hanseatic League, merchants who were allowed to settle in London and undertake trading, originally by Henry III in 1259. At certain times, these merchants enjoyed a monopoly on the import of foreign goods, including corn and other items, and they prospered sufficiently that they were frequently able to make loans to the crown. There's plenty of evidence to suggest that they were a valued and respected part of the London community. The London headquarters of the Hanseatic merchants was an area colloquially known as the Steelyard. This stood on the north bank of the Thames, where Cannon Street Station now stands. It had a quay, warehouses, and a great stone hall where business was carried out. One thing it didn't have was steel. The name has nothing to do with metal or metalworking, but is a corruption of the German word Stahlhof, which means a sample yard. From the earliest days of the Reformation, many of the Hanse merchants were sympathetic to Luther and were instrumental in importing copies of his books into England from North Germany. Their particular situation made them ideal persons for doing this. They had very close contacts with northern Germany and the Low Countries, and they knew bankers, printers, and shippers throughout these areas. Importing books, especially religious books, was a flat contradiction of the law of the land. In 1524, the Bishop of London, Cuthbert Tunstall, had issued a licensing order relating to the import of foreign books. This stated that no foreign book could be brought into the country without the permission of the bishops, and all such books were to be subject to censorship. At that time, one of the most zealous opponents of heretics in London was Sir Thomas More, who was a friend of the king and a servant of Cardinal Wolsey. One Friday evening, early in 1526, he led a raid on the steelyard. He and his men entered the merchants' hall just as they were about to sit down for their evening meal. A short time before, some of the merchants had been suspected of coin clipping, taking away bits of coins from around the edges, and they must have thought that that was the reason for this sudden swoop on their headquarters. But Thomas More was at pains to disabuse them. This was not his reason for interrupting them, and he said, "We have received reliable news that many of your number possess books by Martin Luther. We are also informed that you import these books, and so cause great error in the Christian faith among His Majesty the King's subjects." Several of the merchants were arrested. They were condemned to do penance at St. Paul's Cross near the cathedral, and on 11th of February, together with Robert Barnes, they were forced to kneel in the aisle of St. Paul's Cathedral with bundles of wooden faggots on their backs, and there they were harangued from the pulpit in a sermon by Bishop John Fisher. They were then conducted to St. Paul's Cross, where they had to throw their faggots into a fire, on which at the same time were burned many of the books that they had helped to smuggle into the country. This was all aimed at reminding them of the fate which might await them if they persisted in their errors. Doesn't appear to have had much effect, because we know that the Hanse merchants continued to import books, including copies of William Tyndale's translation of the New Testament. The Hanse merchants continued to thrive in London throughout the 16th century, but they were faced with increasing opposition from native traders who resented their success. And in 1598, Queen Elizabeth I, who supported a rival English organisation, the Merchant Adventurers, confiscated the property of the Hanse League and threatened them with expulsion. Although they had their property restored in 1605, they never again regained their importance. We know that there were other German immigrants in England besides the merchants of the Hanseatic League. Many of these were scholars and students who came to the ancient universities of Oxford and particularly Cambridge. But there were also businessmen and craftsmen, both in London and scattered around the country. We have little information about their religious life. If they lived in London, or in one of the provincial cities where there were strangers' churches, they might have worshipped there. But otherwise, we have to presume that foreigners who did not belong to these congregations either worshipped in their local parish churches or went nowhere. There's strong evidence that many of the steelyard merchants worshipped in the parish church of All Hallows the Great, and that others worshipped in Holy Trinity the Great. In the late 1960s, the tombstone of one of the masters of the steelyard, Jakob Jakobsen, whom we mentioned earlier, was unearthed on the site of the former graveyard of Trinity the Great. So, although we can be absolutely certain that there were Lutherans among the foreign communities in London, it's interesting that no Lutheran congregations came into existence in the England of Elizabeth or the first two Stuart kings. We have to assume that Lutherans were satisfied that the Anglican Church of the day was sufficiently close to them in belief and practice, or that they were happy to worship in the stranger's churches. So we have completed a substantial part of our walk around Lutheran London. And in our next talk, we shall move on from the site of the Steelyard to what is now the Dutch Church, a descendant of the so-called Strangers' Church that was established during the reign of King Edward VI.
Thank you for listening to A Lutheran Walk Through London with Pastor Roy Long. If you have any questions or comments about any issues raised in this program, write an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. Check Lutheran Radio's program online and stay tuned.